Welcome, everyone, to the November session of the 18th season of the Denver Community Kollel's Torah for Tycoons program. Thank you to the Harry H. Barron Trust, as always, interrupted by Zev Barron, for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons as we continue our 18th season. Again, to mention, this is our Chai season. So we are, or Hashem, thankfully, after into our 18th year, we are alive and well and having come through COVID, although it's still ongoing. But we look forward to bringing more classes as we move forward. I'm excited to inform you of a very special event this Sunday, a Hachnosa Sefer Torah, as we celebrate the completion and inauguration of the Aragon, Sperber, Singer family's Torah scroll, their Sefer Torah. The completion of the Torah will take place at 12:30 p.m. at the Ethel A. Barron Auditorium. That's 1261 Zenobia. That's by the Beis Yaakov dormitory area, down Zenobia near 12th Avenue. Followed by a celebratory procession up the block to the Kollel Torah Center on the corner of 14th and Zenobia, which will take place approximately 1:15 p.m. And that will be accompanied by live music, and we will have the acclaimed singer Joey Newcomb. Some of you are familiar with him. He's become a very popular singer in the Jewish world over the last few years. I also want to announce that this month's T4T class, as many of you have seen on the emails, is in conjunction with Clean Speech Colorado, which is now in its third year, and this year is focusing on Shalom, peace, for the month of November, and hence our class this month is focusing on mediation, which, as we will discuss, is a more peaceful way to resolve conflicts than straight-up litigation. We'll talk about arbitration as well. So they are focusing on Shalom, on peace, for the month of November. If you'd like to sign up for this program or see more information about what this groundbreaking movement has for you. And by the way, they now have a program in the state of Illinois as well, so it's growing into a national movement. You can visit cleanspeech.com. Again, that's cleanspeech.com. And thank you to Rabbi Lieben and to all the other wonderful people at the Jewish Experience who are leading the way in this program. I also want to encourage all of you here to consider having a conversation with one of the Kollel rabbis about the Kollel's Live on Life and Legacy program. Anyone who's been on here in the past has heard about this already. It's organized and offered by in Denver by Rose Community Foundation, and it's helping the Kollel and many other Denver organizations create future financial stability through planned giving like wills, estate planning, and endowments. You may think that it's not for you. What do I have to offer? But in fact, there is a lot to anyone can really be a part of this if you would like. So without further ado, I present Mr. Abraham Z. Melamed, mediator at Melamed Mediation from Los Angeles, California.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Again, sorry, I apologize for being late. And I actually made a last-minute decision not to share the screen. I want to keep everyone in focus and not distract anyone. If anyone can't hear me, just let me know. So for those of you who don't know who I am, my name is Abe Melamed. I'm the better looking, smarter of the three brothers that you might know from the Kollel, or the two other brothers, Yosef and Yitzi. But I'm an attorney. I'm a mediator. I practice in New York. I practice in California. I practice across the country sometimes. And I'm, you know, really looking forward to kind of just talking through the different elements of what litigation is, what mediation is, what arbitration is. I don't know how much detail you got into, Rabbi Fleischer, but.
Not very far.
Not very far, okay. And I'm gonna leave the smart, important stuff like the halacha to the right people. So I'm gonna try to stay focused on the other pieces. But you know, I guess the first question, you could put a show of hands, no one has to unmute, but has anyone here heard the terms or been involved in either a litigation, arbitration, or a mediation? Let's see a show of hands. I see a bunch of hands. Okay, good. I'm going to assume it's not in a bad way that you were, you know, the wronged person and you had the right to be bringing that, but you should have at least a little bit of an idea. Let me give a little bit of a framework of what the three different, you know, processes are that exist in the American legal system, and I'll try to sprinkle in a little bit of some of the interesting ethical and halachic issues that I've had come up over the years. And I'm going to try to keep my time, you know, tight, but if you see me going over, Rabbi Fleischer, just flag me.
Okay,
so the first is, what is litigation, what is arbitration, what is mediation? Those are three terms a lot of you may have heard. A lot of people talk about them interchangeably. They're very different things in many ways. So litigation is the same thing as a lawsuit. When you hear the term lawsuit, it's the same thing as litigation. when you have a dispute with someone about anything, where you're asking them to give you something, right? The Gemara term hamotzi mechavero, it's alav haraya. If you're asking someone to give you money for something they owe you, they, you know, hit your car, they did something to your business, whatever it might be, and you want to do it by force, you know, obviously you can ask them to give it to you, but you want to use the American legal system to do it. The most common way to do it would be through a lawsuit, and that's a litigation. And so I'm going to go through kind of the three different categories and then delve in a little bit more into each of them. But for litigation, you're in front of a judge, you're in front of a jury. The Seventh Amendment to the Constitution gives you the right to a jury in almost every civil case. So you're going to be in front of a judge or a jury. You're asking someone to make a decision for you, right? I have this dispute. Someone hit my car. I want them to pay for it to be fixed. Make the decision who is in the right. Either they have to pay me or they don't have to pay me. The vast majority of cases in litigation will settle at some point, but the process of it is basically saying, make a decision for me. Arbitration, right? And there's a lot of elements to that. There's the discovery process. You file your lawsuit. They put in an answer. You engage in discovery where you share documents or you take depositions, sworn testimony. But ultimately, your goal is to have a judge or a jury decide for you the outcome. Arbitration is exactly the same thing, just privatized, right? The way that I would explain it is, you know, the government is involved in the prison system. Sometimes they hand out that job to private sector to do it, right? Here, come run this process. Arbitration is the same sort of thing. It's private court, and it's usually one judge. You're not going to usually get a panel of people, and it's usually either a retired judge or a lawyer who has a lot of experience in that subject matter. And you're also going to them to say, give me a decision, make the decision for us. There will always be a winner or a loser when you get to the outcome, when you get to the verdict in a court, a litigation, or in an arbitration. And it operates much the same way. You file your demand, they respond with an answer, you go through the discovery process. It's supposed to be streamlined, it's supposed to be quicker, although lately it hasn't been the case. And it's a process where you can, you know, businesses like it for various reasons, we'll talk about them, but you go through the same process. You're asking that person to make a decision. Now, frankly, arbitration in some ways is more final than litigation, because in a litigation, you will always have a right to one appeal to the first level appellate court, which does a de novo review in almost every circumstances. That's, de novo is the Latin for, you know, brand new with new eyes. So if you don't like the outcome, they may not disturb the factual findings. The judge or the jury decides what the facts are. They may not disturb that, but you'll get a chance to show it to an appellate court. And in arbitration, the courts really say, we trust what went on behind the closed doors of arbitration. So unless you show me real fraud, or, you know, the arbitrator exceeded their authority to decide an issue that wasn't before them, you're almost never going to have an opportunity to ask the courts to review that. Now, the thing about arbitration, we'll get more into it, is it has to be a voluntary agreement to enter into arbitration. When you agree to that might be at the beginning, but it has to be an agreement between both parties that you're going to go through that. And based in, for example, Befton, is the American Jewish legal system. It operates like an arbitration. The American legal courts recognize it as an arbitral tribunal. And so if you agree as two different parties to a dispute that the arbitrator that is Befton is going to make this decision for you, the courts are going to generally enter a judgment in favor of whatever the arbitrator decides. So that's what arbitration is. Mediation is a very different process, and a lot of people think of those interchangeably, but a mediation is a very different process from an arbitration. Mediation is when you have someone who has subject matter expertise and a psychological awareness, and they use tools to help the party structure an outcome, structure a resolution. A good mediator is going to use not just law and psychology, but things like neuro-linguistic programming, right? Some people, you walk into a room, you see they're a visual person. You want to make sure to put up charts and show them how it operates. Someone's auditory, you might walk in and, you know, bang on the table to make a sound so that you get their attention. But your objective is basically, you're not deciding the outcome for the parties. You're helping them come to an outcome together. And most importantly, and this is where I think it ties in very well with the topic, it's about peace. You're bringing them to terms with each other's positions, which two people can have exactly opposite accounts of the very same facts. And, you know, every good marriage therapist will say that about a marital dispute, that both sides really believe, they truly believe that they're in the right. But in reality, they're just very different perspectives on what happened. And so a mediator's job is to help the parties to communicate with each other in a way that their lawyers won't necessarily be able to do, where they're taking positions. It'll help them to communicate the underlying issues. usually it's not just about you owe me money. No, I don't. In some business disputes, it is. But in an employment case, it's the employee feeling like they were slighted when their employer didn't, you know, invite them out to lunch. And then it manifests itself as a discrimination case. In a family dispute, it might be about, you know, well, I feel like my father favored me, you know, you over me. And so he, you know, the award of how much of the business goes to me is, you know, less and I should get more. And there's usually underlying issues. And so mediation is not deciding the issue. You may play that role in some part. You may be directive in the way that you talk to the parties. Listen, I've litigated this type of an issue for years. This is how it's going to go. Or, you know, I don't really buy that argument. Or even a credibility assessment, you tell the lawyer, you know, in another room, you pull them out and you say, listen, your client's just not that credible. But ultimately, your objective is to help the parties to communicate with each other. And oftentimes, you actually bring the parties together to actually do that communication. And as the mediator, you're just kind of controlling and moderating it. So a common question, any questions, I guess we can get to at the end, but, I'll keep going. A common question, shifting kind of the second piece of this, is a common question is when would you utilize one versus the other, right? When do you have a litigation? When do you have an arbitration? When do you have a mediation? So for litigation, actually the better way to think about it is starting from arbitration. Arbitration, you need to agree to. Right? The parties need to agree to go to this private arbitrator to decide this dispute. Now, most people do this on a daily basis. You agree to arbitration without even realizing it. You click through on a website, their terms of service, and it says, you need to arbitrate a dispute with us. You trade cryptocurrencies on Coinbase, it says, you need to arbitrate this with us. And you might not even realize you've agreed to it. In the employment context, you might see it. They may tell you, here's an arbitration agreement, but you don't really realistically have a choice. It's either sign this or you're fired, or either sign this or you're not going to get hired. And so the parties have to agree to that process, and only then can it shift into arbitration. And a lot of the lawsuits that surround arbitration have to do with whether or not the parties actually did agree to this. There's a lot of, you know, congressional action. There's currently the FAIR Act that the House actually had a hearing on this morning. I had talked to the subcommittee in the House on this issue. It's basically to ban forced arbitration in the employment context. A lot of states have done this in cases like sexual harassment cases, where they feel like it's a way for, you know, people to abuse people and then hide behind the veil of arbitration. But there's a lot of measures that are pushing to get rid of a forced arbitration. And, you know, the way to think about it is, if both parties agree to it, and in a business context, it may make sense, right? We're both business people. We're engaging in a business relationship. If this is going to be resolved, we don't want the publicity of a lawsuit. We don't want the amount of time it might take. We want to just send this to an arbitrator who we trust is going to be able to resolve it quickly and in the fairest way. But in most circumstances, it really is. It's what's called a contract of adhesion. It's where one side has a superior bargaining power and they can kind of force you to agree to it. And so, you know, a lot of businesses, if any of you are business owners, it's great for you. 100%, I recommend that you have arbitration agreements if your laws allow it, if the state's law allow it. Because it's always going to be better for you. The statistics are just abysmal. Plaintiffs in arbitrations, there's a study that was recently done, in conjunction with this congressional hearing that found about 4.5 to 5% of plaintiffs win. People saying, you owe me money for this reason, only 4.5 to 5% win in arbitrations. In court, that's typically more like 30 to 35%. So just the statistics in the whether you're going to win altogether are so, so different. And then the verdicts that you see, I mean, you know, I'm involved in employment litigation. Tesla, one of my colleagues just, you know, took down a $137 million verdict against Tesla. That will be knocked down. The courts will reduce it, but you don't have that in arbitrations. And one of the main reasons for that, and it's one of the biggest issues with arbitration that critics argue, is the arbitrators are paid. So you go to court, you file your lawsuit, it costs you $400 to file that lawsuit, and then you've paid all your dues because it's paid for by tax dollars. And in arbitration, you got to pay that arbitrator for their time. And most single arbitrations will cost about $75,000 to $100,000 just to administer it. And the person who usually foots that bill is the business. Let's say you're in an employment relationship. The business is always going to pay for that. The Supreme Court ruled it would be unconstitutional to force the plaintiff to pay for that process. So it's very expensive, and most arbitrators earn most of their money from the same handful of companies. You know, Morgan Stanley might pay millions of dollars to AAA or JAMS, one of the, you know, main arbitration companies, to arbitrate their specific disputes. And now you have an arbitrator who the vast majority of the $1 million he made last year came from Morgan Stanley disputes. You think they're likely to give a $137 million verdict against Morgan Stanley? Probably not. And so, an interesting halachic piece that's, you know, I think come up is whether as a business owner you should be forcing your employees to make these decisions. I'd say consult your local Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Fleischer might have some insight. But can you force your employees to agree to it? Something that I personally think is really problematic is employers, let's say, who paint a utopian picture for people. So in their arbitration agreement, they say, this process is so wonderful. It's amazing for you as the employee. It's quick. We foot the bill for it. It's just, it's a phenomenal process when you're, you know, no employee understands just how bad it is for them. And I can say with virtual certainty, I mean, there are very few things that I'll say without hedging as a lawyer, but almost unequivocally, a plaintiff is always better off in court than in an arbitration. And almost unequivocally, a business is better off forcing their employee or their consumer to agree to arbitration than to be able to go to court. One other kind of piece that I just want to touch on about it is that you have what's called class action waivers. If you're not familiar with a class action lawsuit, that's where a lot of people band together to bring one type of a claim. And it, your claim might not be valuable in itself. It might be worth $5,000, $10,000. No lawyer is going to fight for that. But if you bring thousands of people together, it could be millions of dollars in recovery. It's a way to fight against, you know, big businesses that take advantage of people on a smaller scale. Class action arbitration waivers is common, where when you sign that arbitration agreement, you say, I will not file this as a class action. And the Supreme Court in a case called Epic Systems a couple of years ago said that that's constitutional. So you end up sometimes with kind of this reverse system where now you have thousands of people, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people filing individual actions in arbitration for the same kind of an issue. And then ironically, some of these businesses are trying to fight to have their own arbitration agreements not enforced. You know, Amazon, for example, had 75,000 people file individual arbitrations about Alexa recording their conversations, cost millions of dollars, and Amazon said to the court that they should, their own arbitration agreement should not be enforced. Judge Alsup said, you know, that he wouldn't sanction it. I think actually that was a DoorDash one where Judge Alsup was involved, but basically, yeah, DoorDash, he said that faced with having to actually honor its side of the bargain, and they blanched at the paying the fees. They never expected how many people would file it, but the hypocrisy won't be blessed. And there's been workarounds since then. Some people started using other companies that don't allow people to file mass arbitrations. But the bottom line is it's great for businesses. It's great for, you know, companies that sell consumer goods. It's terrible for plaintiffs. It's terrible for employees. And so there's a lot of, you know, general concerns about forced arbitration. Mediation. You know, and so, okay, so sorry. So to go back for a second, the court process is very similar, except that you don't have to agree to it. That's just your main recourse when you have a dispute and you haven't agreed to an arbitration. And that process can take a long time, 4, 5, 6 years sometimes, especially if there are appeals. It's public. It's a constitutional right for it to be public, which is good for you and bad for you. In some ways, you know, people don't want it to be known that they were harassed or that this happened to them. Other types of lawsuits, people don't really care as much. Companies sometimes care about the lawsuit and they might want to resolve it because of that. But in court, you usually have much better statistics. A recent study of employment discrimination cases had a 1 in 3 chance of a plaintiff winning, 2 in 3 that a business would win. So, you know, anytime you have a dispute, those are kind of your two avenues if you want to try to have it resolved by a decider. You are going to tell me what the outcome is going to be. And the way that interplays with halacha and with the Beis Din is that the courts recognize them as an arbitral tribunal. So you might have issues come up where you have a divorce with someone who's no longer religious and their spouse is religious. Spouse says we should go to Beis Din, and the other one says no, they're not agreeing to it. The American legal system does not recognize that. They won't say you're forced to go to this arbitration. You haven't agreed to it. And then you may have some issues where a get is involved, and you might have a civil court then saying this divorce should be final in this way, but they're not giving the get. And there are some courts that have started to get involved in this in a pro, you know, women way, I think, and when it comes to Gittin, for example, there are, you know, New York courts have established things where they'll penalize someone if they think the divorce should be finalized, but they refuse to give a get. But the bottom line is you need to agree to arbitration in order to end up in a Beis Din in America. And so when you have a dispute with other frum Jews, you know, I've had cases of frum guy who, you know, worked for a Jewish day school and was fired and believed it was discrimination. Everyone agreed that should go to Basedin. They agreed to Basedin. Basedin's outcome was entered with the court. I've had cases where there was a terrible sexual assault involving two from Jews, and I ask a Shiloh always, and the answer was Basedin has absolutely no business or ability to resolve a dispute like that. It's just not within their purview. Now, again, I'm not a rabbi. That's just what I was told on that case. I leave it to Rabbi Fleischer to offer any insight into that. But there are some very interesting interplays, and that's kind of how Basedin is regarded in the American legal system. And so just the last piece about mediation, and it's, you know, it really is an amazing process, that I'm really pro. I think in any litigation, it's something the parties should consider. A lot of mediations take place before a lawsuit's even been filed. But almost every case will settle at some point, and it gives the parties an opportunity to control that outcome. They get to decide what they want to see happen. Sometimes at the end of a mediation, I have two family members who were in a business dispute about the family business hugging and crying because you brought them back together. It's, you know, it really is a beautiful way to bring peace in people who otherwise are communicating only through their lawyers in a positional way. I demand this and I demand that, and there's fighting, and you bring them together, you find out they're not really that far apart. So, you know, there are times where it's just not feasible to mediate or to resolve it. You want $1 million. They want to give you $5,000. There's nothing really to talk about unless, of course, there are underlying issues. And so that's why oftentimes it is going to be worthwhile to bring the parties together to even have that process just to get to those underlying issues. But it, again, it's more than just positional bargaining. It's using psychology, neuro-linguistic programming to understand, to help people be heard, not just speak to respond, but speak to listen. And it really is a great way. It's not splitting the baby. It's helping the parties structure that agreement together. And they can get to outcomes that a judge or a jury or an arbitrator might never be able to give them. You know, in an employment case, it could be a positive reference. It could be the tax treatment of the settlement payment. It could be confidentiality. You know, I've had personal injury cases. You could have, you know, the company will assume the mortgage of the person because that's the biggest concern they have. They don't have to pay out a lump sum. They know that they can pay it out over 10 years or 20 years. And they're willing to pay more money. There are a lot of creative solutions you can get from a mediation that you can never get from an arbitrator. You can never get from a court. So that's just a little bit. There's a lot more that I can say. I don't want to go too long if people have questions, and I want to give it to Rabbi Fleischer. But mediation, arbitration, litigation are very different processes. There are different times when you might use one versus the other. And if anyone has any questions about any of that, I'll put my email also in the chat. You can always reach out to me.
Thank you very much. If anyone does have any questions now, feel free to unmute yourself and ask the question. And
so I had a question. I was interested to hear more about the processes that courts go about in enforcing the decisions of religious courts, of a Beit Din, and how that process happens, because I could imagine there being all kinds of potential, you know, conflicts between the way in which a Beit Din might reach a decision and the kinds of outcomes that a court might be more comfortable enforcing, especially, you know, if there's a ruling from a Beit Din that's not just a pure, you know, this person owes this person X dollars, right? That's relatively easy to enforce. But if there's, you know, specific performance of some sort, and, you know, things like that where it becomes a lot more complicated to enforce the judgment, how do courts get involved in situations like that?
Sure, it's a great question. So I think the answer, you know, as if you want to think about it in a broad sense, is arbitration is a contract, right? People can contract for virtually anything they want to. And it could even be contrary to American law. If it's really against public policy, you can't. But You know, generally speaking, you're agreeing, you know, in a Basedin, you might have this, it's actually fairly common in the divorce context where you'll have a consent decree or a mediation, you know, mediated resolution between the parties in Basedin, where Basedin's involved, and Rabbi Fleischer, I'm sure we'll talk more about, you know, Pshara versus Din when it's, you know, let's figure out how to make this relationship go forward. But as long as that contract, that agreement, is not something that really violates public policy, the court is going to say, that's what the parties have agreed to, I'm going to enter this contract. In the same respect, if they've agreed to submit the question for a din from a Basedin, tell me what to do in this situation, it's again a matter of contract. You've contracted to agree to this outcome. Now, if you had a Basedin, and I don't think it would happen, but if you had a Basedin that said, the father is never going to see his children ever again, but he's going to pay 100% of his income to, you know, alimony. a court might look at that and say, listen, that violates public policy. But as long as it's within some rubric, and they're pretty liberal in how they don't try to kind of look into the process of the Basin, they look at it like any other arbitration. An arbitrator at JAMS deciding an employment dispute is on the same level as a Basin. Yeah. Any other questions? I don't want to take away from your time, Rabbi Fleischer.
I've got all night. Famous last words.
Not everyone else does, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Okay, so I will get over then, if there's no other further questions at the moment. I will again share my sources. Give me one moment.
While you pull that up, I'll just say I have sources that I put together for virtually everything that I've talked about. If anyone has any questions or wants to see something, I'll put my email in the chat now. You can always just reach out.
Okay. So are we good? Can someone just give me a thumbs up or something that you can see my sources there?
I see it.
Thank you. Okay. All right. So as I started before I was so politely interrupted earlier, we have, and I want to, first of all, thank you very much to Mr. Melamed for presenting tonight. And as he said, he has a lot more to talk about. And just what I have here, I don't know if we'll have time to get to everything. I have way too many sources. And then there's a lot more beyond what's on here that we can talk about as well. But like you pointed out, I may have all night, but not everyone else does. So we'll see how far we get, and we'll see what we have time to discuss. But let's just try to get to the basics of what you call din, which is litigation, versus pishara, which is the common term used for what we would call compromise. But as we will see, this compromise takes on different forms. So we do have a verse, as I said before, in Parshas Vayeshanan, in the book of Devarim, you shall do what is good and proper in the eyes of God, v'asisa hayasher v'atov, be'enei Hashem elokecha. And that goes off in a lot of directions. It goes off in a general moral sense of going beyond the letter of the law, as Rashi says. But also, says Rashi, refers to compromise. So right off the bat, we have an idea that Rashi is expressing to us, that compromise, and he's going in the context of litigation, is something which is good and proper in the eyes of God. And this idea is actually not agreed upon by everyone in the Talmud, because while Rabbi Yeshua ben Karchan, source number 2, says it is a mitzvah to create a bitzua. Now, I left that word in the Hebrew because, as we will see, there are two different terms used for compromise. This one is called bitzua. Bitzua means, if you are familiar with Hebrew, like the word emtza, in the middle. And so this is kind of to meet halfway, to create a compromise of sorts. Says Rabbi Yeshua ben Karchan, it is a mitzvah to create a bitzua. More about exactly how that works soon. But Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, says it is forbidden to be botzea, to seek a compromise in court. And whoever creates a bitzua is a sinner. So he comes diametrically opposed to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karchan. And he says that if a judge in a court is seeking to create compromise, that is wrong. Rather, let justice pierce the mountain. That is, in Hebrew or in Talmudic lingo, Yikov Haddin Es Hahar, which is a way of saying you've got to go with the letter of the law. And so would Moshe say, that is Moshe of Torah fame, let justice pierce the mountain. Moshe was the judge. He judged and he ruled for the Jewish people. He was the chief justice, shall we say, of the Jewish people. But Aaron, his brother, says the Talmud loved peace and pursued peace and made peace between a person and his fellow. So here, the Talmud, the Gemara, even in the context of Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, saying that a judge in the context of litigation cannot seek compromise, makes the point that Aaron, his brother, took a very different tack. And Rashi explains, when Aaron heard of a dispute between them, between people, before they came before Moshe for judgment, he would pursue them and make peace between them. So Aaron would seek to basically be a mediator. Before the case even came to judgment, Aaron was, I guess we could say, one of the first mediators, certainly the first mediator we find in the Torah, who is trying to make peace between people before they come before Moshe for judgment. And Tosfos, over there on the spot, he explains a little further, because he wasn't a judge and the case wasn't coming before him, but rather it was coming before Moshe, it was certainly permitted. So Tosfos kind of explains and lays down the parameters for how this works, even according to Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi. And that is, there's a difference between a case coming before a judge. If you have a case coming before a judge, so then the judge, according to Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, he has to litigate it. He has to judge the case, decide who's innocent, who's guilty, who's liable, who's not liable, and so on. However, Aaron, who was not the judge, was able to try to get a hold of these individuals before they went to court, before they came before Moshe, and to try to mediate a settlement between them that would lead to peace, a peaceful resolution that would create peace between them. Okay, and this is clear in a number of places in the Talmud that Moshe's role was to lay down the letter of the law, while Aaron's role was to create peace, to be more connected with people, not necessarily the one who's laying down the letter of the law. And the Talmud, in fact, goes so far as to say that the Jewish people mourned to a greater extent for Aaron than they did for Moshe. Why? Because Aaron was, in a certain sense, more popular, shall we say, among the masses than Moshe was, because Moshe was the judge. And he was the one laying down the letter of the law. Well, Aaron was the one who was trying to pursue peace, to create peace, to make people feel good. And he wasn't the one laying down the letter of the law. And therefore, he had, in a certain sense, a greater popularity among the Jewish people than did Moshe. Of course, each one had his own unique role. Moshe had his role and Aaron had his role. But you see these two different poles, if you will, of resolving disputes, Moshe judgment and Aaron as far as trying to mediate. Now, whose opinion do we follow? So the Talmud continues, source number 3. Rav said, the halacha follows Rabbi Shua ben Karcha. Now the Talmud explains, what does that mean? It's a mitzvah to look for a compromise. It is a mitzvah to say to the litigants, that means when they come into court before the judges, is a mitzvah to say to them, do you wish din, judgment, or pishara, compromise? Here we have the term pishara as opposed to the term bitzua. Okay? What is the difference between the two? We will hopefully get to soon, but hold on to those two terms for now. Pishara versus bitzua, they both basically mean compromise, but they actually, as we will hopefully discuss soon, they mean two somewhat different things. The Talmud continues with a bunch of sources for the idea of seeking compromise in the context of a court, of a Jewish court of a Bezdin. And it quotes a verse in the book of Zechariah, truth, justice, and peace judge in your gates. Okay? That one should judge truth, justice, and peace within the gates of one's cities. And the Talmud says, what is justice that has peace? And the point the Talmud is making is that when you litigate, someone is right, someone is wrong, that doesn't lead to peace. The fellow who lost is not going to be thrilled that he lost. So how do you have justice that has peace? Say that this is bitzua, this is compromise. Compromise leads to peace. And in fact, a much, much later halachic authority, the Shvus Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, who lived, I believe, in the 19th century, one of the major halachic authorities of the 19th century, he says, again, during a long responsum, he says the main purpose of Peshara is only to make peace between the litigants. Very interesting line, he says. There are other reasons, which if we have time, we'll get into why a judge is encouraged to seek Peshara, to seek compromise. But he says the point is to make peace between the two sides. Okay, so that is just a little background before we get into the nitty-gritty of more details. That is some of the background of the source of the idea of a Bezdin to seek pshara, to seek compromise between the litigants. Now, here's an interesting question. As I mentioned before, there are two different terms used in the Talmud. One is bitsua and one is pshara. What is the difference? So without getting too much into the exact meaning of the verbiage, what each word exactly means, there are commentators, the Tosfos HaRosh says, and others talk about this idea as well, that here's the question. When a Beis Din proposes compromise and they move ahead with Pishar, with compromise, is that an expression of Din? Is that an expression of judgment? We are rendering a judgment. It so happens to be we are rendering it in the form of a compromise. Or is this not judgment, rather it is an alternate path, a whole different approach called Peshara, called compromise. Would you look at it as judgment, as a form of din, or is it something totally different? And they explain again, based on the meaning, the exact meaning and source of each word, that one word indicates that it is a type of din, a type of judgment. It is a fulfillment of the Torah's mandate that justice be served. And that's kind of borne out in this source number 4, what justice has peace. Okay. And that's Bitsua. And the word Bitsua represents the more judgment slanted approach to compromise. Whereas the term Peshara is that you're taking a different approach. It's a different approach. It's not judgment. It's not din. Rather, it's more of a, it's looked at more as of a mediation type approach rather than alternative judgment approach. And it's just an interesting concept. And I don't have time to go into it, but it may have ramifications into how you view and therefore halachic ramifications into the processes that go into a compromise. Does it have to follow all the processes of a Beis Din? Or not? Is it just mediation, and therefore not all the rules of a regular Beis Din, of a regular Jewish court of law, apply? And in fact, there is a discussion in the Talmud, do you need three judges to litigate if you are going with the approach of Peshara, of compromise, like a regular Din Torah, a standard Din Torah is supposed to have three judges. There might be exceptions. I'm not getting into that now. Or can you go with even one judge off the bat? Because it's not really Din, it's not really judgment. It's more like mediation, and therefore one judge would suffice. So again, I'm not resolving that question here. I'm just putting it out there that this is some of what's going on in the context of understanding how to view on a deeper level this idea of compromise. Now, the Shulchan Aruch rules that just as a judge is warned not to skew the din, so he is warned not to skew the pshara toward one more than his fellow. Okay, there is no shortage of injunctions in the Torah against judges skewing, favoring one side over the other. And the Shulchan Aruch, Chosha Mishpat, rules that same idea, that same injunction, that same warning to a judge not to favor one side over the other applies when it comes to a Peshara just as much as it does when it comes to as much as when he's actually judging the case in full-fledged in letter of the law. Now, this indicates that, in fact, Peshara is akin to a din, to a judgment. Furthermore, it tells us that Peshara is not standard mediation, and we'll see a lot, many more proofs to this as we move along. Peshara, the approach of compromise, is not the judges sitting down with the parties as Mr. Melamed described mediation, where you have a third party trying to bring the two sides to a resolution that they both agree with. No, because it's pretty clear from this source that, in fact, the judge is judging the case and he's not allowed to show favor to one side more than the other in his judgment. That makes it pretty clear that the classic case of Pshara is, in fact, a judgment of sorts, but it's a judgment where he is not sticking to the letter of the law per se, but rather is creating arbitration, which gives more leeway in the judgment that you don't have to go with the exact letter of the law. We'll try to talk more about how it works as we move along, but it's clear that Peshara, the classic case of Peshara, is not mediation. It's much closer to arbitration, where you have a panel of three judges they based in making a decision, not necessarily based on the exact letter of the law, but with more leeway for varying different kinds of factors that will play a role in their decision. But at the end of the day, they are the ones imposing a ruling on the litigants, and the litigants would have to accept that ruling. Okay, so it's much closer than I would think to arbitration than it is to litigation. It's different from the arbitration described by Mr. Melamed earlier, because there you have the arbitration in the secular world is not taking place in a courtroom. It's taking place with another party. Whereas this is taking place with the actual judges who a moment ago were going to litigate the case full-fledged letter of the law din, are now moving over to an approach of more arbitration of Pshara, where there's more leeway for the exact judgment. Now, till when can the litigants decide that they want to go in for Pshara? So source number 7 says, once the din is completed, it is impossible to seek a compromise. You can't go for Pshara anymore. What is the completion of the din? When does that happen? Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, once the judges say, so-and-so, you are liable, so-and-so, you are innocent. So here the Talmud rules, and this is the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch. There is some discussion exactly of some other opinions, but this is the basic halacha, that once the judges render their ruling to the parties, it's too late. However, so long as they have not actually imposed, rendered their rulings and stated, announced their rulings, the parties are allowed to go ahead and say, we want a pshara. Okay? What happens when one party wants a pshara and one party wants din? that is a little more complicated, and we're not getting involved in that right now. Okay, but their life does get more complicated in terms of, we'll see that, I don't think we'll have time to get into it a lot, but generally Bezdin cannot impose a pshara, but Bezdin cannot demand that the parties go for a pshara, and if the parties demand din, Bezdin has to deliver din, has to deliver strict judgment, letter of the law. When one party wants din and one party wants pshara, what kind of pressure a Bezdin is allowed to put on the party that wants din? So that there's a lot of discussion. It's not a simple matter at all in terms of what kind of pressure they're able to impose. Okay, generally a Bezdin cannot force. They can try to convince, persuade, but generally they cannot force it. How far does this idea go? Well, any Bezdin, says the Rambam, that consistently creates compromises, praiseworthy. When is this said? Before the judgment is completed. And even though he heard their words and knows in which that word does should be deleted, in which direction the din is leaning, is a mitzvah to create a compromise. So even though the judge, here he refers to the judge or the judges, heard the words of the litigants, and he knows which way this case is going, it's still a mitzvah to create a compromise. Now, let's be clear. If the judge hears the arguments of both sides, and he realizes one guy is clearly in the right, and one guy is clearly in the wrong, then it's not necessarily the right thing for him to encourage the parties to go for pshara. But when he sees which way it's leaning, both men, let's say, have a case, he can encourage a compromise. And then again, even though he knows which way it's leaning, the compromise would then probably come out much more favorable to the side that seems to be more in the right. But again, it would avoid going with the letter of the law. Okay? And I want to just pause on this idea for a minute and expand on it a little bit. It's pretty clear in a lot of sources that a Bezdin, certainly in today's day and age, and when I say today's day and age, I mean for the last many, many hundreds of years, shies away to whatever degree possible from rendering an exact letter of the law judgment. Part of this reason is because din is very harsh. It is very a letter of the law. And like we said before, let the din pierce the mountain. And if you, as often happens in courts where there is a law which maybe is not fair or doesn't favor someone, but that's the law. That is the law, and it may not be fair, and it may not play well into one party's hands or the other, and one party might be technically right, but because there's a law, or because there's a technicality, or some other reason, he's going to lose the case when really he should be winning the case. So din is a very complex thing to try to impose and invoke, because it doesn't choose, it doesn't play favorites. It doesn't always give you that who really, at the end of the day, seems to be the right party. He won't necessarily win if, because of a technical issue, the party that really should be right is missing something or said something wrong, or so on and so forth. And judges shy away from imposing strict din. That's one reason. The other reason is to actually get to the bottom of a case, to actually ascertain exactly and precisely, according to Jewish law, who is correct and who is not correct, who is liable and who is not liable, and so on and so forth, is no small matter. And judges shy away from it because it's an enormous responsibility. It's very clear in the Torah and the Talmud that it's an enormous responsibility. And judges prefer not to take that responsibility on their shoulders of deciding who is absolutely right and who is absolutely wrong according to the letter of the law of Torah. And therefore, they will almost always encourage some sort of pishara, which allows more leeway for you can ignore certain technical issues. Or perhaps a person is liable not in Bezdin per se, but he's wrong anyway. So let's just give an example. There's a halacha called grumma. Grumma means that if I cause damage, if I indirectly cause damage, I am usually off the hook in terms of paying damages. Okay. However, in many cases, the Talmud says I am liable by the hands of heaven. That means if I were to go ask, a rabbi, what's the right thing to do? He would say you should pay. But Bezdin cannot find me liable. The letter of the law says I'm not liable. Bezdin cannot say you are liable to pay, but the right thing to do is to pay. So in such a case, if there's pshara, if there's compromise, Bezdin will say, well, the right thing to do in this case is for you to pay up or to pay some of the money because you did indirectly cause this damage. So while according to din, you may not be liable, but according to pshara, we'll find you somewhat liable, let's just say, because you were in the wrong to some degree. And so Bezdin will almost always pursue making a pshara whenever possible because of this issue. more about that shortly. Continuing along on this idea that once the din is completed, once the judgment is rendered, can you still seek mediation? So Abraham mentioned that when you have a ruling handed down by a court, so then you can still go to the appellate court perhaps and have an appeal, and certain parts of the case can be appealed, and so on and so forth. Halacha generally does not have room for appeals. If it can be proven that the judge was flat out wrong, meaning he missed a ruling, or you know he just made a mistake, a flat out mistake, so that may be grounds for undoing the ruling. That's a very complex area of halacha. Sometimes the judge himself may have to pay back the money. Sometimes the whole ruling is nullified and the case has to be retried. That's a complex area of halacha. But generally, if the judge knew what the issues were, he didn't make an egregious error in missing a ruling or in making a straight up error, but rather he rendered a ruling and one of the litigants wants to go to another court and get them to disagree with the first judge's or the first Beis Din's perspective, there's not really room for that generally in halacha. Okay. However, let's just see over here. Even though once the din is handed down, the judges cannot seek compromise. It says, however, one who is not a judge is permitted to create a compromise between them, but not in the area that is set aside for judgment. So here the Shulchan Aruch gives what we might call, what according to Mr. Melamed, would be arbitration. And that is that if the litigants agree to go to another party, not in the context of judgment, not in a Beis Din, but in some other place, and they accept upon themselves the ruling of a third party, so then indeed they can file for arbitration, even though the ruling was already handed down. That they are allowed to do, but again, both parties would have to agree to it. So both parties would have to be dissatisfied with the ruling in order if they wanted to pursue that approach. Another important, very important source over here, which is somewhat controversial, is the Shach, Rabbi Shapsi Cohen, citing Shulte Giborim. And he says like this, it seems to me that all these things are not said except when the judges wish to impose a pshara based on what their eyes see without the das of the litigants. Now, I left that word das in Hebrew. It's a hard word to translate. Das in this context means without the input, without the acquiescence, without the parties getting together and trying to reach a mutually agreeable resolution to their conflict. Okay? But if they inform them of the nature of the pshara and appease them to the point where they agree to forgive each other, or for one to give something to the other, it is proper to do so, so long as there's nothing forced upon them, just appeasement and persuasion, and this is a great mitzvah, and bring a peace between man and his fellow. Here the Shach, again citing Shulte Giborim, who is a, I believe, 15th century halachic authority. The Shach was a 17th century halachic authority, is saying the following idea. True, once the judges hand down their ruling, it's too late for pshara in the classic sense of what we were talking about until now, of what we would call arbitration type pshara. However, the judges are allowed to try to convince the parties to mediate some sort of agreement so that they will be at peace with each other. Usually when there's litigation, one party wins, one party loses. The party that wins is very happy. The party that loses is usually not going to be very happy, and in fact, may be quite upset. And therefore, in the interest of creating peace between between man and his fellow man, between one person and another, it is permitted and even encouraged for the judges to try, after the ruling is handed down, to try to get the parties to reach some sort of agreement where maybe I won the case, but I will forgive something of what I won, or some sort of agreement where the parties can live with each other, despite the fact that one guy won and one guy lost. But nonetheless, this idea of trying to bring peace between them, this pshara of a trying to make mediation, the judges themselves trying to mediate between the parties to bring peace, is still on the table, says the Shach, even after the ruling is handed down. The judges themselves are allowed and even encouraged, according to this approach, to do so. Not everyone agrees with this, but it is cited by the Shach. It is cited by others as well to take this approach. Okay? And to take that further, the Nesivos HaMishpat, Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum, a great 19th century halachic authority, he says the discussion that three judges are required for pshara is only true for such a case where the judges impose a pshara. But for appeasement, what we will call mediation, even one suffices. And the idea seems to be that when you're dealing with mediation, that's not a judgment. Okay? Pshara, in the classic sense, which is more of an arbitration, is a judgment. True, it's not the letter of the law. True, there is some leeway. Not every exact halacha has to be followed. And the judge has leeway to say, well, even though technically you're in the right, but you still messed up and are wrong, and therefore you won't win the entire case, and you'll have to pay something, or you won't get as much money as really you should get because you messed up somewhat and you're somewhat in the wrong, whatever it may be. But that's arbitration. That's being imposed. It's a judgment. And therefore, it needs three judges. For mediation, it is the two parties coming together and making peace, like Abraham discussed before, and therefore it only needs one judge. Okay, as I mentioned before, Beis Din cannot force a person to go beyond the letter of the law, even though it seems to be proper, but there are those who disagree. This last line, "but there are those who disagree," is a tricky line. Again, Beis Din cannot force a person to make a pshara, which, as we started off saying, is going beyond the letter of the law. I want to come and litigate. And Beis Din says, no, make a compromise. Make a compromise. So even though I have the right to demand straight up litigation and din, nonetheless, says the Ramah, generally you cannot force. There are those who disagree. There's a lot of discussion. It's not every case. There are very specific circumstances where a Beis Din may have the right to impose pshara, which brings us to source number 13. It is permitted for a judge to make a din similar to a pshara in a situation where the matter cannot be clarified. What happens when you have a case that comes before a Beis Din, and the Beis Din, the judges, just cannot get to the bottom of the case for whatever reason? There's not enough evidence. They don't know this. They don't know that. And so on. What to do in such a case? They cannot give an actual din. They cannot get to the bottom of it. There, they have a right to say, we're making a compromise. Okay? And this brings us to a halacha, which is known as a pshara karov ledin. Pshara karov ledin means a compromise that is close to the din. There's two kinds of pshara. There's two kinds of compromise. One kind of compromise is where the Beis Din will listen to the claims, and they will make a compromise based on what they see as being proper, based on their knowledge of halacha, based on what they're hearing from the parties. But it could be that their decision will be very far from what a normal classic litigation din type of ruling would have been. Could be quite far from it because they're taking a lot of factors, other factors outside of the actual letter of the law into account. And it could be very, very far from what the actual ruling would have been. Din karov lipshara is a form of pshara, which is where Beis Din has to really look into the halacha. What should the halacha have been? What should the ruling have been if we would have given it according to the letter of the law? And then what they'll say is, we'll make a compromise, but the compromise is really very much based very closely on what the letter of the law would have said. Now, how close does it have to be? So some sources say that a Beis Din cannot knock off more than a third of the money that would have been awarded to one party in a court case if they are doing pshara karov ledin. So let's say, just keep things simple, let's say Mr. A is litigating against Mr. B, has a claim against him, and Mr. A would have won $300. Beis Din says, okay, really, he would have won, but we went to pshara karov ledin, we're not going to litigate fully, they cannot give him less than $200 if he's in the right. Conversely, if the defendant is in the right, and really he should have been innocent, but Beis Din sees the case and says, really, you have to give something. So there they could force him to give something. Let's just say let's just say that the claimant wanted $300, and Beis Din really would have ruled that this fellow is totally off the hook. They cannot make him give more than $100. They can't rule more than a third off, according to this approach, from what the din would have been. That's called pshara karov ledin. And in some major batei dinim, I believe I saw that the Beis Din of America, their form, when you sign a form for the arbitration form, which Mr. Malabin mentioned earlier, which is the binding contract of arbitration that will hold up in court, on there it says that you are agreeing to either din or to pshara karov ledin. That is what you are signing on that contract, the contract that I saw at least today online. You could Google it and look it up yourself. On the Beth Din, I believe, is of America, or Beis Din of America, and they have a form of arbitration which the litigant signed, and it says you are agreeing to din or pshara karov ledin, to a compromise close to judgment, which means that they may not give you the exact letter of the law, but it will be pretty darn close. Okay. And just to conclude my sources here, and then I'll just, even though I am going a bit over time and if someone has to leave, please, I will not be insulted and we'll stop for questions when I come up for air. But just the last source over here, even though the litigants agree to a pshar and bezin, they are allowed to renege so long as they have not made an act of kinyan. And this is a very interesting source, because if the litigants agreed to a compromise, but they did not make a kinyan means an act of acquisition that makes it binding. If I want to acquire your car, if I want to buy if I want to buy a watch from you, I have to acquire it. That makes it mine. That makes the agreement binding. If I want to obligate myself in something that is intangible, there is something called Kabbalah's Kinyan, where an act of acquisition, again, I'm not going into all the details. If you've ever sold your chametz for Pesach, so what happens is the rabbis through whom you are selling your chametz will give you a pen or some sort of object and you pick it up. And that is what we call a Kabbalah's Kinyan. You are acquiring that pen, and you are basically, through that act of acquiring the pen, you are transferring the rights to sell your chametz to the rabbi. And then you give him the pen back. But that is what's called a Kabbalah's Kinyan. In Beis Din, in order for the pshar to be binding, you have to have a Kabbalah's Kinyan. Some point to this as a proof that pshara is not a form of din. Because if it's a form of din, you don't need a Kabbalah's Kinyan. You don't need an act of obligating yourself in order to be obligated by the din, by the actual judgment that is imposed by a court. And yet you do for a pshara. So that would seem to indicate that pshara is not full-fledged din. Maybe it's a form of it, but it would seem to be more of a mediation type thing, even though it does seem to echo more arbitration. Now, just to comment on what Abraham said about different cases and when a bezin would get involved and when a bezin would not, in terms of what kind of cases and so on and so forth, in case of a divorce and of a bezin of the courts getting involved in forcing a get or a husband to give his wife a get, or other cases such as assault and these kinds of things, that's above my pay grade. So I really can't comment a lot on that. All I can say is that every case is unique, and there are many, many complex cases that come up. And so each case has to be ascertained by a very competent Orthodox rabbi who knows these areas of halacha well, which is not me. I'm just good at giving classes about it, but I don't actually weigh in on these things, from a practical standpoint. So you really have to address these questions to a rabbi who is highly competent in these areas. To go to a rabbi who is not highly competent and to have that rabbi render a judgment could be disastrous in terms of halacha and so on. And they are very complex. When should you go to a bezin? When should you not? The whole New York get law, as it's known, with levying fines, and I think there was even at one point, I don't know if it still is today, imprisonment perhaps for the recalcitrant husband and so on, was very controversial for many reasons on many levels in terms of halacha. So going to a secular court as opposed to a bezin is no simple matter. There is in general a prohibition against doing so. Again, there are many exceptions, but it really needs competent guidance from a halachic authority about when a person is permitted to circumvent the bezin process and go to a court, and when one should go to a bezin itself. That wasn't my topic of discussion tonight, but again, I hope I've given over a little bit over here of how pshara works in general, in a general sense, a little bit of in today's court system that, as I mentioned, bezin will seek a pshara, and in fact, bezin will usually, before they even sit in judgment, they will listen to the case and hear the claims, and very often encourage mediation to start with, or they'll tell they will tell one party, you don't really have that much of a case if you take it to din, but if you go to pshara, then you have a fighting chance of getting something, and they will discuss with the parties beforehand what to expect and so on and so forth. One dayan in Lakewood, who I spoke to this week, he told me that generally speaking, if a person walks in very confident, I want the din and I'm right and I'm going to win, he's usually the guy who loses the case, because he's usually the guy who doesn't understand that there's almost always two sides to a story. As Mr. Malami pointed out, there's almost always two sides to a story. And for one person to say, I'm totally in the right and you are totally in the wrong, is not that common. And so for one person to walk in and say, I want the din because I'm right and I have no doubt there's a good chance he will end up losing the case because he's overconfident and he's not wise enough to see that there are two sides to the story and he's not necessarily in the right. So it's always a better idea to seek either mediation, certainly beforehand, as we see, it's a great mitzvah. And the whole idea of Peshara, even though it's imposed as arbitration, is really meant to bring a greater deal of peace, that you don't have one clear winner and one loser, but rather that you should reach some sort of middle ground. Yes, it's imposed by Beis Din, but nonetheless, the goal is that there shouldn't be a clear winner and a clear loser, but rather that each side gets something out of the case. And mediation, certainly, if they can mediate before it goes to court, and as we saw, possibly even after the ruling is issued, that promotes an even greater degree of peace. And if that's feasible, that is a path that is often pursued as well. So that is my presentation. If there are any final comments or questions, now's your big chance.
I have a couple things to tie it together, but I can say if anyone has a question, you can jump in. But I think that all those things are actually in many ways paralleled in the American legal system. You know, the judges, the courts, and many courts, almost every court will have some mediation program. They push you into it. In the Southern District of New York, for example, it's mandatory. Once a party files an answer, you have to go to mediation. So courts are very much in line with that. And there are times, just like you said, of the pshara even after din, so to speak, because you know, if you, let's say, have a jury verdict that's like $137 million against Tesla and the judge knocks that down, in the federal court system, you have two choices. You can take the number they knocked it down to, or you can retry your case altogether and potentially lose. So a lot of times in a case like that, you're going to actually come to a settlement after the fact. You're going to agree to it. And the judges are going to always be instrumental in trying to resolve that. So I think there's a lot. And there's an interesting kind of ethical piece that's come up for me is, you know, using the arbitrator as the mediator. I've had cases where my client needed to hear from the person who was going to decide the case that they were going to lose in order to get it to the settlement. So sometimes you do that, but in the context of arbitration, it requires informed written consent. Both sides have to sign off and understand that the person who might decide this is mediating it. So it's definitely interesting. And I think the other point I'll just make about the halakhic piece. Yeah. I always, think through when there are Jewish parties involved, these types of questions and ask someone much smarter than me. And my response is usually, I like these questions much better than I mix the milchik spoon and the fleshik pot. But, it's definitely something that I think is very nuanced and having someone that's trustworthy and understands it to kind of help you guide through that process is important. So I think there's a lot of parallels. I think that, you know, the American legal system derives from the English legal system, which ultimately I think derives from the Talmudic legal system. So there's a lot to say. And I think peace judges today also, they don't want to render a decision ideally. Juries are a decision, but judges don't. They would rather try to come to some sort of a peaceful outcome.
Okay. Thank you very much, Yasher Koach. And thank you everyone for coming and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you all. And if anyone has any questions for me, you've got my email in the chat. You can grab it.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Can I get any questions?
Oh, sure. I'm still here.
Oh yeah. Go ahead.
Can you clarify, in the arbitration system, does the arbitrator have to follow the regular parameters of American law, or is there sometimes a different system that they could be following?
That's a good question. I thought of that when Rabbi Fleischer was talking. The answer is that they don't have to follow some of the strict parameters. In fact, for example, hearsay evidence, which you cannot bring into a civil court, is admissible in most arbitrations, unless the contract you sign when you agree to what the arbitration will look like says you will apply the federal rules of evidence. So there are some more loose parameters in the arbitration process. But at the same time, the arbitrator is going to make a decision at the end of it. And it, you know, in a business dispute, it might be we're splitting up the business in this way. But if it's you hit me with your car and you owe me money, I didn't hit you with my car, I don't owe you money, that arbitrator is going to ultimately render a decision. They don't have any control over that, you know, kind of creating a mixed outcome. But there is some leeway in terms of the rules of evidence and things like that.
But the judge would not be able to use their own judgment based on the circumstances and what they feel is fair. It's just going to be following a strict structure.
Correct. And they're usually going to be required to issue a written decision that explains how they came to that outcome. I credited this person's credibility. I did not credit this person's credibility. So it's a looser process, but there's a winner and there's a loser at the end of an arbitration.
Got it. Thank you very much.
And I wish everyone a wonderful evening. Take care.
Thanks for having me. Have a good night, everyone.